Well, I think of factors to investments as chords are to music. You put them together in different ways, you can create songs that really cry out and songs that celebrate other things for different styles of music like classical or jazz, but they're all based on this common foundation, and that's what factor investing is all about.
Hey everybody, it's Greg Fisher. Today's topic is very close to my heart. It's the terrain where I've spent my entire career. Some people call it quantitative investing, others call it systematic or rules-based. I like the term multi-factor. As head of research at Gerstein Fisher, I make it my business to follow everyone worth following in the world of quantitative investing. And one of the best and brightest minds out there is our guest today, Andrew Ng. Andrew is the head of factor investing strategies at BlackRock, as well as a former professor of business at Columbia University. Andrew and I both entered finance at the dawn of the digital revolution. He went more of an academic route, and I became a portfolio manager. We've crossed paths many times as fellow members of the Q Group, and we have many friends and colleagues in common, plus a shared interest in music. I give Andrew my highest rating. Here's our conversation. Andrew, thank you for being here with me today. You have a really impressive and interesting background. And for our listeners today, I'd love it if you'd share a little bit about your background, how you got interested in quantitative and systematic or factor investing. Tell us a bit about your journey.
Thanks, Greg, for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be here. My journey to factor starts all the way back. I was born in Malaysia. And in Malaysia during the late 1960s and 1970s, there were a series of racial conflicts. And my parents wanted somewhere safe for their children to live. So they immigrated to Perth, Australia, and I grew up in Australia. Like typical Asian parents, they wanted their children to be doctors. And yes, I did actually get my doctorate, just not in the right field that they wanted. I worked for a little bit, and then I took a much bigger leap to come to the United States for graduate work, to actually become a doctor. And Stanford, where I did my PhD, is where I found factor investing done rigorously for the first time in terms of theory, but I also wanted more. I wanted to see it really work in the real world.
Approximately what year would that have been?
So I started my PhD in 1995. I started teaching as a full-time professor at Columbia Business School in 1999. I was privileged to work with some of the largest, most sophisticated investors around the world. One of them was the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. I've always wanted not only to understand why, but to also make a difference. In 2008, Norway experienced some very bad returns, like many investors during the financial crisis. Norway's losses exceeded 20%. But what really got Norwegians was not so much the total drawdown of the fund, but what they were really angry with was they underperformed standard major market indices. Why, they wondered, should we be paying so much money for active investments when government bureaucrats could be producing a better outcome? And that's when I was hired together with two other professors, Will Gertzman at Yale and Stephen Schaefer at London Business School. And they've become very good friends. So here I was, a Malaysian-born, Asian, Australian, American, New York City teacher trying to look at a Scandinavian portfolio for an entire country.
That's unbelievable.
Right in my wheelhouse. And I understood then that this could really make a difference to millions of people. And that's when my journey to factors, combining both academics and wanting to make a difference in the practical real world, took root.
What you probably didn't know was that some young guy named Greg Fisher was hanging out in a corner in Brooklyn, New York, reading about some of the stuff that you had done. And that's right around the time, 2008-09, is when I launched our factor funds for retail investors. And it's interesting the way the work of others influences someone like me. So you've made a really influential impact on my personal life, but also my business. So thank you.
factors are to investments what nutrients are to our eating well. And we want different combinations of nutrients, and it's not the dish per se in front of us that really sustains us. It's the nutrients beneath, the carbohydrates, the protein, the fat, and so on, but put in the right quantities and expressed in the right way. And that's something that I think an ordinary person is far more able to relate to than a very complicated quantitative procedure. But we can be very complicated and sophisticated in the kitchen to present those nutrients in a very appetizing way. And that's my job as a chef. Right. Actually, to be honest, I'm a really terrible chef. But I think in the world of factor investing, my chef skills there, cooking skills for factors are a little better.
I remember an analogy someone once shared, salt, cheese, sugar, tomatoes, that's not pizza. But when you put it together in a certain way, it becomes pizza. And I think we've all had all sorts of pizza that tastes differently, but it's basically the same ingredients.
I'm old enough to have bought many cassette tapes, but I bought a lot of those for just one track. And I didn't listen to the whole thing, the whole album. I just listened to a couple of tracks. And what's happened in music today with the rise of streaming services, I'm still a SoundCloud user, right? But
sure.
You can use Spotify, great IPO, or Amazon Music or Apple Music, is you don't need to buy the whole thing. You listen to the tracks that you want to, when you want to, and your playlist is the better for it. And what's happened in asset management today is exactly the same process that music has already undergone. And we used to go to one fund manager, and that person would give us the whole thing. Market cap exposure, factors, the broad and persistent exposure. And we would also have what we would call today true alpha insights like timing or security selection, but you had to buy the whole thing. Today, what we can do now is separate those. We can unbundle, and instead of buying the whole album, buy the tracks that we want and put them together for the appropriate portfolio. And just like your playlist, your portfolio is the better for it.
I know when I started Gerstein Fischer in 1993, I felt completely inspired by factor investing. I was reading all the research and literature, probably stumbled onto some of yours in the 90s. And I had a vision that we could really change the world. I was experiencing how regular, ordinary people were investing in these sort of old methods while all this new research was emerging. And I, like you, I think had this idea that I wanted to take these academic principles and put them into the hands of actual investors, real people. At that time, many of my friends, went off and became institutional money managers or hedge fund managers or whatever they were doing. But I really wanted to bring these ideas to the people.
And that's exactly what's happening to this. It's factor investing is democratizing excellence in investing to the ordinary person. And it used to be that back when we had the 70s and 80s and even up to the 90s, that only the largest, most sophisticated institutions, and they were institutions, had access to these factor sources of returns. But now, with data and technology, we can spread out a track to thousands of people. You don't even have to buy the whole album to do that. And you can even get it when you want, in whatever format you like. Factor investing democratizes access to broad and persistent sources of returns. So it's data and technology that allows us to identify cheap stocks across thousands of different stocks, to identify trends across thousands of different assets. We can identify those. We can form an optimal portfolio. We can then put them into an efficient vehicle like an ETF, and then we can put them into your portfolio in an asset allocation program. Data and technology is absolutely essential to do all of that.
I think that's perfect. I mean, as you know, this podcast is called The Q Factor, and it's all about how data and technology is changing all aspects of our lives. I know you and I've joked around about this, but I trademarked the term factor, multi-factor, in the form of investing about 10 years ago. Now it just hangs on my wall, but the idea that we were able to get that trademark because the term was not being used in the public domain for investing, to me, is shocking now, because here we are 10 years later and this stuff's become the rage. I mean, what happened? Why all of a sudden is the term factor so popular in conversations across the industry, investors. It's like a kitchen table term now. I think most of my friends even know what factor investing is, and it was nowhere to be found 20 years ago.
Everybody wants to buy something for cheap. They want to find and participate in trends. They prefer holding companies with higher quality earnings. They would like to gravitate to safety, which we do in minimum volatility strategies. And sometimes you'd like smaller, more nimble securities, which is a small size factor. None of those are actually new. But empowered by data and technology, it's the access that's new. It's the way that we can now do this in scale. We can do it transparently, cheaply. We can put it into tax-efficient vehicles, ETFs, and we can form model portfolios, and we can even push out all of those insights to illiquid markets like private equity and view that in a factor lens, real estate and infrastructure, and obtain total holistic factor portfolios. That's what's new.
The momentum factor is like this big, powerful one. That's an important one, right? We all talk about it a lot. I'm just curious your take on the momentum factor these days, you know, given what we've just experienced over the last 10 years.
Well, momentum certainly is observed in every asset class. It is due to an underlying economic rationale of investors' biases that you extrapolate trends. You want to follow the crowd. And that's why we see momentum in markets. Momentum is based on this solid economic footing. We want to be able to harvest momentum in different ways. So we can look then at what the best ways are of implementing momentum. We can first look at past price trends, but we can go a little bit further than that because sometimes you might go up in a very choppy fashion, or you might go up in a more stable one. So we can push forward to then perhaps controlling for risk in identifying the past price trends. We might look at price trends relative to each other. We can also look at fundamental trends. So instead of just looking at price behavior, perhaps looking at what analyst revisions are or economic fundamental momentum. And those are all, I think, important considerations of an economic concept like momentum might be well understood. You also might see that intuition about where it arises in an economic setting. But finally, going to actually get it, well, requires skill. And I think it's a good analogy here is going back to our cooking example, factors are to investments what nutrients are to food. In order to cook well and to serve something well in a restaurant, you need three things. You need a recipe, you need access to ingredients, and finally, you need a chef. And so you can think about that recipe as being, well, what metric do I use for that particular trend? And is it different in equities or emerging markets? Is it different in fixed income? So I need a list of ingredients for those recipes as well. And those ingredients are the inputs that you might have, the ability to create different investment products like an ETF, how you should combine them, what's your portfolio construction. And then ultimately, you can have the best recipe and best access to ingredients, but you can still put them together in a lousy fashion. So the chef does matter as well.
Here's another important concept as it relates to factor investing, value. So for our listeners, the value factor is the idea of consistently owning a portfolio of companies who have low prices relative to some of their fundamentals, such as earnings or book value or sales. There's a lot of ways of doing this, but that at a high level is what we're talking about. I mean, the key thing is to have price in the numerator and some common element in the denominator, such as earnings. Now, as of this month, January 2019, over the last decade, growth stocks have outperformed value stocks by, depending on the benchmark you use, about 250% cumulatively. Now, these are some actual numbers I pulled this week. The Russell Pure Growth Index over the last 10 years has earned about 19% annualized, and the Russell Pure Value Index has earned about 11% annualized. Now, I know the value factor is something we all hold near and dear to our heart. So bottom line, I'd love your analysis of this value factor, given the pattern. I mean, does this performance justify growth stocks?
Yeah, Greg, you know, the big story in factor land for 2018 is the underperformance, the very large losses that the value factor endured. It had flat performance in 2017, and then it had very large losses in 2018. To put that into perspective, in the Farmer and French data set, which starts in the 1920s, the drawdown that we've seen recently represents the fourth worst episode for value in almost a century of data.
Wow.
The worst one is 1999, and we're about half as bad as that. So a good question is why? So value firms perform best coming out from an economic bottom. They tend to perform worst at a late economic cycle. And no doubt we're late. It's just a question of how late.
Right.
And in some areas of the world, they have already entered that slowdown. The reason is that value stocks tend to hold a lot of physical capital. Think about factories and production lines, plant property and equipment. And they're very good at efficiently producing those goods or those services. But it means that during the late economic stage, when you'd really like to pivot and have that flexibility, you can't. It's impossible for a factory to start producing another good overnight. And so, not surprisingly, during late economic cycles or during economic recessions, value tends to underperform.
Growth stocks have this asset of, you know, whether it's their R&D or other intangibles, just the special things they do that aren't things like buildings and immobile at things that are not exactly accounted for in their book values or maybe even affect their earnings in some way. Is it possible that we need to incorporate these intangibles into the way we think about value investing? Like, could some growth stocks even really be a value stock in disguise at this point?
Oh, great point, Greg. And let's touch on a few of those areas. We always have to put our best research into factors. And if we don't, it's a little bit like Shakespeare. He produced some great plays. He wrote with a quill and ink. And then if we don't evolve, well, we would be writing screenplays today or making movie scripts with a quill and ink. You want to do that with the best data and technology available. And I think one of the things that you just touched on, Greg, is that traditionally we've been very good at focused on identifying low prices relative to intrinsic value using financial variables, in particular book to market. But if you don't evolve beyond book to market, you're like, well, Shakespeare today, who hopefully wouldn't use a quill and ink, but you'd be stuck. And book to market, well, that was the paradigm of the 80s and 90s, and you have to get smarter today. And I think many companies today, they see intrinsic value not only in the physical assets they own, but also the human capital behind those companies. And we can get smarter about estimating the intangible value, and we should absolutely incorporate those insights into these new versions of value.
This idea of incorporating intangibles into the way we think about valuation, I think, is critical. And it's nice to hear these things because it's not like this journey is complete, like all the learning we need to do is done. That would be a foolish thought. There's so much more learning we can all do and so much more research to do, which is, of course, what makes this exciting. Thinking about the future a little bit, you know, I was actually talking to Bob Merton not very long ago. I was asking him about this. I believe that there's still a benefit to having an informed human being involved in all of this, that, you know, computers may not just take all of this away and put us all out of work. Certainly technology and data is assisting us, but this idea of an informed human being at the end or the beginning or the middle of all of these processes, what's your take on that?
Well, that's the chef, right? In order
exactly.
to create a great dish, you take that recipe with the ingredients. You might have a great drum set, but you still need a drummer.
Right, exactly.
And so even though that music is written on a score, you need someone to bring that to life with the appropriate instruments. And all of those analogies, I think, are exactly what happens in factors. We need that human element, that judgment. We also need the data and technology to provide a scale and to implement efficiently. And we also need data, the underlying inputs. All of those three things are absolutely essential.
So tell us a little bit about some of the new things you're working on at BlackRock. Something that caught my attention in the media just a few weeks ago was this partnership that you guys now have with Microsoft. And I don't know how much about that you can talk about at this point, but that looked exciting to me. Again, you know, in a conversation with Merton, he was referring to the retirement crisis that's looming. You know, this idea that there are so few people in America that have enough money to retire, and that, you know, we as an industry, certainly academics, need to think a lot about, you know, how do we help solve that problem? And when I read about this thing you guys were doing with Microsoft, it got me interested. I was wondering what that was all about.
Well, that's a partnership that focuses on, I think, the leading problem of our time, retirement. How can we retire with dignity, with financial well-being? And I want to tell you that Factors has a really important part to play in there. And we've launched a series of target date smart beta funds. And that brings the best of Factors to help solve this retirement problem. And let me tell you exactly how they work. One of the big advances in the area of retirement was the introduction of that target date fund to shift from riskier securities when you're young, like equities, to more stable, risk-free securities like bonds when we're old. And when we're actually in retirement, we want that safety that those risk-free assets can provide. Now, we can go one step further. That's an equity bond glide path as we go through our life cycle. But we can even think of a factor glide path as well. When we're young, we're going to hold more equities. But the types of equities that we should hold, well, we can tilt that equity portfolio away from standard market cap to rewarded factors, return-enhancing factors like value, momentum, size, and quality. When we're old, close to retirement or at retirement, we're going to hold fewer equities, but the equities that we should hold should reduce our risk. And so we're going to hold now an equity portfolio that is tilted towards minimum volatility strategies. So now we can think of a factor glide path on top of an equity bond glide path. It actually gets even better because arranging things this way and giving access to other sources of returns, broad and persistent sources of returns, creating superior diversification, allows us then to actually have more growth orientation at the later stages of our portfolio. And that's really important because when we retire, we're still going to live for a very long time.
Absolutely.
We might even take a second career. And being able then to provide resilience and stability in the portfolio using factors allows us then to participate in growth going forward during those late stages of retirement.
Thinking about asset allocation strategies for people's retirement, thinking about their preferences and risk-taking behavior, there was another research piece that you did a couple years ago, I think you might have updated it more recently, that really had to do with this issue of tactical asset allocation. And obviously this is a difficult concept, but what are your thoughts about this idea of being able to make decisions around whether you're in value or growth or small or big or quality or, you know, so on, based on the economic environment as compared to making those decisions only around people's personal circumstances?
My advice first is to hold a strategic multi-factor combination and use that as a core holding. And around there, you may, but it's optional, want to adjust your portfolio for various circumstances, including investment opportunities. But first, let's hold a multi-factor combination as a strategic holding. If you would like to be more tactical, then I think the economic cycle is just one of a series of different signals that one should look at. Today, we said that we're in late cycle and value, as we've seen over the past couple of months, usually doesn't do that well. But this is the time that minimum volatility strategies tend to stand out. And we've seen minimum volatility add value, whereas the value factor detracted in 2018. The economic cycle is important, but so is how cheap or expensive a factor is. And so that might be a second signal that you could use. Relative strength is a form of momentum. And then finally, you might look at dispersion. And that requires a little bit of explanation. What we'd like to see is large differences for value in the valuations of value versus growth stocks. And actually, I should call them value versus expensive or glamour.
I call them growthy growth stocks.
We should look at large differences in past price trends of winners versus losers, right? Or put another way, if you can't really tell the difference between value and growth or winners and losers, then this is probably not the right time to be looking at overweight positions in value or momentum factors respectively. So using all of those, you might then obtain some weights, but they're all relative to this long-term strategic multi-factor combination. Today, we're overweight minimum volatility, and we have an overweight position to momentum. In our international portfolios, we're long quality. Those things will evolve as we go through, but should you time factors? Well, it's optional. And I think actually for most investors, it's no. But please don't hold just one factor. Like what we've seen in 2018, holding just one factor like value, it's risky. Let's hold a well-diversified multi-factor combination as a core holding.
Yeah, the multi-factor approach for most investors is the right approach, the diversified approach. Even though maybe an argument could be made that if you put all of your money in micro-cap value stocks and locked them away for the next 70 years, when you woke up, that might be the best performing thing you could have done. But as you probably know...
I think though, Greg, if you did that for micro cap, what about the stocks that are value and cheap and they're trending with high quality earnings?
That's even better.
And that's a multi-factor combination.
Absolutely. So, Andrew... First of all, obviously, it's been great having you here with me, and thank you so much for doing this. This is fun. Speaking with you about factor investing is a little bit like speaking with Babe Ruth about baseball. You know, I have tremendous respect for all the work you've done, and thank you. So what do you want our listeners of this show to really take away from this conversation today? You know, at the high level, what do you hope that people got from this discussion?
Well, factors are reimagining the way we invest today. And I want to leave three things to everyone listening today. See, know, and act. Look at what's really inside your portfolio, just like what's really inside your food. And is that suitable for you? So know what is the right factor combination. And then, with that knowledge, after looking inside and observing the factors that we own, act on that. Add factors that you might possibly not have. Add factors that will give you an outcome, like portfolio resilience. See, know, and act. And welcome to the land of factors.
So we have a tradition on the Q factor. It's called the three Qs. These are three questions we ask every guest, no matter what their background or expertise. One is... Beyond finance, where do you see big data having the biggest positive impact on the world over the next 10 years? It can be science, manufacturing, music, climate change, anything.
Well, this question is really, where would big data not change the world? It's actually, I think, hard to find an area that would not be touched by this.
That's right. Yeah, I'm finding the same thing. It seems like it's affecting all of us, and hopefully in positive ways. Maybe there are some things that people would think of as negative, but it's hard to find them. So the second question then, the flip side, you've already answered to some degree, which is, where do you or can you think of a place where big data might threaten the world, where it does pose perhaps a threat?
Rather than think about threats, I think about opportunities and improvements in people's lives. Big data applied to factors, well, actually, we talked about that factors have always used big data in various forms. And this has only raised the standards for true investment skill. I think that for those traditional active managers who may be threatened, actually, that's a great thing for the average consumer.
Absolutely. I think that this will continue to drive fees down. And those that are out there trying to outperform peers and benchmarks in some way, they're going to just be held to a higher standard, and that's probably a good outcome of big data. Last question, number three, AI, friend or foe?
Friend and foe, but let's make sure it's a friend.
I love it. Andrew Ng, thank you very much for being here on the Q Factor with us. Look forward to seeing you again soon. That was my interview with Andrew Ng of BlackRock, truly one of the best minds out there in the world of factor investing. Hope you found it as illuminating as I did. If you liked today's episode, don't forget to subscribe to the Q Factor and give us a good rating on iTunes. We have some phenomenal new interviews coming up. Stay tuned. I'm Greg Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Greg Fisher is founder and portfolio manager of Quent Capital, a registered investment advisor. Economic and market views and forecasts stated by Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital are current as of the date of this podcast and are subject to change without notice. This presentation is not intended to be a solicitation of any kind. It is for general informational purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results. The views of the guests that appear on the Q Factor are their own and may not reflect the views of Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital. Thank you.